chapter 20 of the book of Revelation and the first six verses. Strange language. This is penetrating right into the future, looking ahead to something that has not yet happened. Chapter 20, verses 1 to 6. It's written by a man in prison, a Christian, put in prison because he's a Christian. Written on a Sunday morning, when God showed him there in the prison the things that he was going to do in the future. Things that God was going to do. And part of it was the unfolding of the ultimate future of the history of the human race. And here is this little section of it. Then I saw an angel come down from heaven with the key to the bottomless pit and a heavy chain in his hand. He seized the dragon, that old serpent, the devil, Satan, and bound him in chains for 1,000 years and threw him into the bottomless pit, which he then shut and locked, so that he could not fool the nations any more until the 1,000 years were finished. Afterwards he would be released again for a little while. Then I saw thrones, and sitting on them were those who had been given the right to judge. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their testimony about Jesus, for proclaiming the word of God, and who had not worshipped the creature or his statue, nor accepted his mark on their foreheads or their hands. They had come to life again, and now they reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. This is the first resurrection. The rest of the dead did not come back to life until 1,000 years had ended. Blessed and holy are those who share in the first resurrection. For them the second death holds no terrors, for they will be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Now, I didn't realize how appropriate and how relevant this little series of three sermons was going to be when I started, but when I preached on Christianity and communism, it was in fact the week of the annual Congress of the British Communist Party. When I preached on capitalism, I only found out afterwards that there was a big conference in Rome at which Mr. Heath was speaking, met from many Western European nations to discuss one subject, the future of capitalism. That was last week. Now I'm going to talk about Christianity. But I sincerely hope that you do not feel that all the questions we've been raising in the last two Sunday evenings have been unrelated to the gospel of Christ. They are very much part of our faith. Now, it is always easier to see what's wrong than to put it right. It's always easier to make a protest than to make a program. That may be why protest movements are so popular. It's always easier to point a finger rather than set to correct the situation. And for the last two Sunday evenings, I've been very conscious that I have been pointing fingers and raising questions and seeing what was wrong with the two systems that have divided our continent of Europe right down the middle. Half Europe lives under communism and half lives under capitalism. I knew that when I preached on communism, I'd run into some trouble from communists. And I knew when I preached on capitalism, I'd run into some trouble from capitalists. Now I'm preaching on Christianity. I hope I don't run into too much trouble from Christians. But is there a Christian alternative? Okay, it's all right for the preacher to get up and slam communism and slam capitalism. But has he an answer? If not, let him be quiet and let the rest of us struggle on as best we may with the system. Is there a Christian alternative? Now, I want to begin by saying far too many Christians give a slick answer to that question, which is not true. I do not believe there is a Christian blueprint for society today. And if we go around saying Christ is the answer, if only everybody adopted Christ's answer, we'd all be all right. Are we sure that Christ has the answer to the political situation as it exists now. I raise that question to prevent you from saying too easily and too slickly, well, of course, Christ is the answer to all these problems. Is he? What is his plan for society? What is his alternative? Has the Christian got the answer? Now, let me just recap very briefly my criticisms of communism and capitalism. Both systems founder on the rock of human nature. Both of them have a naive, optimistic view of human nature. Now, some have tried to correct me on this, and some have said, well, don't you think capitalism is much more realistic than communism, because capitalism at least recognizes that men are full of self-interest and that they will only really give their best effort when they're going to make a lot of money out of it. So we cash in on that weakness, and therefore we are more realistic than communism, which has this naive view that once you get the economic order put right, human nature will be redeemed from sin and selfishness. That's partly true. But I believe that capitalism has a naive view of human nature, not at the point of production, but at the point of distribution. And pure capitalism believes that if you leave everybody in a free competitive market and let supply and demand control the situation, that there will be a fair distribution of the wealth created. And that is not true. Under capitalism, human nature does not share. Under communism, human nature does not become unselfish. Under neither system is man changed. Now, that's my basic quarrel with both systems. In spite of all the details I went into, that's the real problem. Now, some of you raised questions about what I said, because, of course, there's no such thing as pure communism and pure capitalism. Communism gets modified, often in a capitalist direction. And, for example, Yugoslavian communism is very different from Russian communism, and Russian communism is very different from Chinese communism. And they all feel tense towards each other, because each says, yours is not true communism. In fact, it's all been modified. And in the same way, we do not live in this country under pure capitalism. If we did, then you would see the abuses of exploitation, which I mentioned last Sunday night, but we don't. Our capitalism in this country has been severely modified by a good deal of socialism and government control, which have prevented the worst abuses from continuing. I did indicate that last Sunday night. So my criticisms last Sunday night were of pure capitalism, not necessarily of the British sort, which has been very severely modified. But having said that, we've got to look at the two systems in their purity to see what happens. And in both cases, the human freedom of every individual to live a full life is denied. In every case, the few have either the wealth or the power, and the many suffer loss of freedom to live as God meant them to live. And so I now ask, what then is the Christian alternative? Let me begin by saying we have a bit of a problem with the Bible. It is not a scientific textbook, and it is not a political textbook. And therefore, if I want to know scientific theories, I don't go to this book. Not that there is any contradiction between science and scripture, science properly understood. But if you want to know the laws of physics, then don't read this book. It's not a scientific textbook. And it is not a political textbook either. I search its pages for a clear statement, a kind of manifesto of what God sees as the right political system for man to live under, and I can't find it anywhere. I find some things that are going to make me think and be very helpful, but I can't find a political blueprint. You see, when I look into the Old Testament, I find a unique situation, a nation that is church and state at the same time. And there has never been another parallel situation like that, and there never will be, so that I cannot treat Britain in the same way as I treat Israel. Israel was church and state together. It was a religious nation, and it was governed by God and not by man. Or it should have been, if they'd accepted his plan. There was no democratic assembly. There was no discussion of laws. The laws were all made by God and passed on through prophets, and the prophets were the key people. Now, there's no parallel to that situation in an ordinary secular nation today. We have to work out our laws at human level and debate and decide at that level. We cannot go back to Israel's pattern, where God said, this is how you deal with thieves, this is how you deal with murder, this is how you deal with property, this is how you deal with animals, this is how you deal with divorce. We are not in that situation. So the one thing you can't do is take the laws of Deuteronomy and apply them to Britain. Just can't do it. When you turn to the New Testament, you find an entirely different problem, that there you're not dealing with a nation at all. You're dealing with individual Christians within other nations. And therefore, while there's a good deal of teaching about submitting to the state, supporting the state with tax and prayer, obeying the authorities set over us, praying for the emperor, there are no directions to Christians who have political power, because the Church of Jesus Christ was not made up of people in political position. It was made up of slaves largely. And so they are told how to act towards the state. They are not told how to act if they are the state. Of course, there are a few people, soldiers, governors, who begin to get involved in Christianity. But no guidance is given to them as to how they are to make political decisions. And so the Old Testament doesn't help us because it's not a parallel situation. The New Testament doesn't help us because it simply teaches Christians how to behave in a secular state. It doesn't tell them how to govern it or what kind of system to fight for. Indeed, the New Testament's thrust is live within the system and behave within it as a Christian should, as a loyal citizen. Even the system of slavery, which is an unchristian thing basically, was not attacked as a system. Slaves were told how a Christian would live within the system. Even from our Lord Jesus himself, we get little direct political guidance. He came into a red-hot political situation. An occupied country with terrorism trying to fight for nationalistic independence, and he called people to be his disciples from both sides of that divide, from the Quislings who cooperated, from the terrorists. So he called Matthew and he called Judas and he called them into his band and he put them together. An extraordinary mixture. And then when he was on trial before the governor, he said, "My kingdom is not of this world, else would my servants fight. You cannot pin anything political on me. I have not been a revolutionary. I have not been a political activist. You cannot pin me down on either side of these political issues." And Jesus, for the most part, kept politically neutral. From all this, many Christians have assumed that the right Christian posture is to remain politically neutral, to remain out of politics altogether, to remain out of positions of responsibility, to submit to the state, to submit to the police, but not to get involved in any way with such responsibilities. But frankly, you cannot do that. You cannot do that. You can't opt out of society as easily as that. And for better or worse, every one of us is involved in politics. You cannot help it. Apart from anything else, you are the governors of Britain if you are over 18. You are the rulers. You make the decisions, for you have a vote. And if suffering can be relieved by social legislation, then you as a Christian have a duty to be interested. And if law and order can restrain evil and exploitation in this land, then you as a Christian have a duty to be interested, and not just a right. You are involved in asking what kind of a system. The Archbishop of Canterbury has reminded us to ask that question. What kind of a society do you want, he's asking. Well, the deeper question is what kind of a society God wants, what kind of a system he wants, what kind of an order he wants us in Britain to live under. And I'm going to try and probe into that question, in spite of what I've said. Because there is no clear blueprint in the Bible, I do not believe that it is ever right to have a Christian political party. Some Christians have tried this, and on the continent of which we are now part, there are Christian Democrats who deliberately use the word Christian in the election. I don't believe that you can do that, and the last thing I'd like to see in Britain is a Christian political party. The pressure on other Christians from that party would be colossal. You've got to vote for us because we're the Christian party and you're a Christian. even if you felt that they had not understood fully the situation. So I don't think that's the way forward. What then is the way forward? Is there a Christian social order? Well, now, the first thing I want to tell you tonight is this. There is going to be. There is going to be. And for Christians, the one fundamental political belief we have is this, that the answer to the political problem lies not in the right system, but in the right person. It's such a simple and an obvious thing to state, but I want you to get hold of that tonight, because that's the heart of the political stance of the Christian. We do not believe that any system can be right until we've got the right person to run it. That's our problem. Now, this applies in any department of life. When our previous church, where our pastor was considering opening homes for the elderly, I said to those who were keen to do this, look, getting hold of a building is comparatively simple. Getting hold of the money is comparatively simple. The biggest question is, can we get the right people to run it? If so, we're home and dry. If not, we better not start. But in fact, the Lord graciously gave us a man and his wife who were the right people. And we started there, and the system followed. It happens with church activities just the same way. People say, can't we start a club for this age group or a meeting for that? And I say, find the right leader and we can start it. You can have the system right. You can organize till doomsday. But if the right people are not in charge, the thing falls to the ground. Now, that is our fundamental political belief. The basic need of our world politically is for the right leader. That's the basic need. For the simple reason that the Bible makes it quite clear that men and women are made not to live in democracy but under dictatorship. We are made for that. We are made to be subjects obeying a king who does not discuss his laws with us but tells us what laws he has made. That's the basic need of human nature, and we always respond best to strong leadership. The problem is, find me a man who's capable of being this strong leader and making the laws, who will nevertheless respect the individual and be uncorrupted by such power. That's the problem. And therefore we believe that the right system will be a system where the laws are not debated democratically, but where laws are observed obediently. But we believe those laws have got to be made by the right men, and that it's got to be a one-man rule. Now, is this a bit startling to you? But the whole Bible is about just that. That until men and women are totally obedient to the laws of one man, and that the right man, they cannot know true freedom, and they cannot know fullness of life. It applies to the individual, to the family, to the church, to the nation, and to the whole world. And brethren, we believe we've found the right man. That's the Christian political stance. We believe we've found the only man who can do it, the only man who could have such power and who could use it in nothing but love and respect for the individual. And his name is Jesus. And no system will work until he's in charge of it. That's our political stance. That's why we're going to finish this service. Sing with a king who is coming to reign. Glory to Jesus, the Lamb that was slain. All shall be well in his kingdom of peace. Freedom shall flourish and wisdom increase. Now that's our political system. In other words, our system is dictatorship by the one man who's capable of doing that. Because he is the Son of God. Now that's where our political understanding starts. And we believe that until we can get that man back on planet Earth, no system will work. No system is ideal. No system can cope with the real problems, which are basically, one, human nature, two, Satan. These are the real basic root problems why we can never get our politics right. So we start by looking to the future. Good news also, not only do we believe we've found the man, but he's coming back. He's coming back. That's the Advent message, and we're just coming up to Advent. He is returning to planet Earth. And when he comes back, he will take over the governments of the world, and we will live under the benevolent dictatorship of our Lord Jesus Christ, the one who said, whoever would be great among you must be your servant. And at last, the Savior of the world will come. You've just sung about it. Now that's our political hope. Just as the communist believes that the utopian society cannot come until the revolution has taken place on a world scale, so we Christians believe that utopia cannot come until the return of Jesus to this world. Now, I start there. That's my politics. It's impracticable for the moment. But I ask, when Jesus comes back, what kind of a system will he adopt? What kind of a government will he have? Well, I can tell you some things already which may interest you. First, there will be a universal program of disarmament. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not learn war against nation. That's the very thing that would solve a great deal of our economic situation. The greatest waster of material resources is war. War is all input, no output. It produces nothing. It wastes millions of pounds. And when Jesus comes back, the first thing he will order is total disarmament right through the world. Now, I believe that that's an impracticable political policy until Jesus gets back. And that we could get into all kinds of trouble if we tried to run the system without him. But that's his politics. Total universal disarmament. Another plank in his platform, if you like, a sheet in his manifesto, is world government. No longer national government, but world government centered in Jerusalem and in his hands. World government. This world is one world. It's a global village. You cannot run it with many systems. It's got to be run by one. And we know that now. Pollution and population are now universal problems. We need world government. But to have world government before you've got Jesus could lead to all kinds of disaster. Indeed, we know that we will have it, and that it will lead to disaster, and that it'll get into the wrong hands, it'll get into Antichrist's hands. So to have the system before you have the person is politically dangerous. Another plank in his platform will be that all nature will cooperate harmoniously with men. Now that'll solve our ecology problems. When the lion and the lamb can lie down together, and a little child can play with snakes, and man and nature are in harmony again. That's part of his manifesto. But you try and do that without Jesus. There are many other things, but one of the greatest is this. Behind all our problems, behind the greed for money, behind the lust for power, behind the violence, behind the troubles in Northern Ireland, there stands someone who stands to profit by them all, and that someone is Satan. And how he profits by these things. And when Jesus comes back, the first thing he does, I've just read it, is to bind Satan and get him out of this world for 1,000 years so that Satan can't exploit these political questions anymore. Can you imagine what that's going to do? But you try and behave as if Satan doesn't exist before Jesus gets back, and you're in trouble. Now you see, I've painted a manifesto, a political picture. World government, transform nature, international disarmament. There's so much more I could give you. Here's another. He's going to abolish death. So we won't lose the greatest men. So that a professor studying cancer will not be able to be bombed. That's what's going to happen when he comes. Christians call this the millennium. You can call it utopia, you can call it what you wish. Oh, but all shall be well in his kingdom of peace. No wonder, sing we the king who is coming to reign. It's not the system, it's the person. And when the person comes, the system will be put right. That is our fundamental political stance. And that's where we start. Now I want to move on to the next thing. Christians are already under the kingship of Christ, and his Spirit is already able to convey to them his will. Therefore, wait for it, therefore, the church can already be a model community, demonstrating to the world what will be possible universally when Jesus comes back. Now, I wonder if you grasp that important principle. The politics of the millennium should be visible now in the Church of Jesus Christ, in the community of those who already believe in Jesus and who are already able to respond to his kingship. Now let us just think of the implications of this. It means, for example, that the government of every church should be the same as the government of Jesus in the millennium. A church should not, therefore, be run democratically, for that's not how Jesus runs things. How Jesus runs things is to make his will, decide what's to be done, choose leaders whom he appoints, who are not democratically elected, but who are appointed and recognized as coming from Jesus, and who then share with his people what he has revealed. That's the form of government in the Church of Christ. It's to be the model to the whole world of the peace and the prosperity that can come when Jesus gives the orders and his pattern of government is followed. Now, it has to be his pattern. As soon as it becomes anything in the nature of what the world knows by dictatorship at the human level, it falls. And so the Bible says, you elders, lead the flock, but never lord it over them. It's the lording it over bit that spoils it. And Jesus was the one who came among as one who served, even though he never once debated with his disciples what to do. Have you ever noticed that? He always knew what he was going to do anyway. Sometimes asked them what they thought they'd do, and then told them, now we'll do this because I've decided to do this. He said to them, you feed the 5,000. They said, well, we can't. Right, he said, now I'll tell you what we're going to do. And Jesus never debated with the disciples what he was going to do. But what he did do was share with them all along the line what he was going to do. He said, I have called you friends. A servant doesn't know what his master's going to do, but I call you friends because I tell you. I share it with you. And there should be total sharing of what God is revealing as his will. But where you've a church where Christ is dictator of that church and tells the church what to do, and where the leaders of the church are not those who are democratically elected because the people like them, but are recognized as those whom Jesus has given, then you find a prosperity and a peace and an order that is a model to the world of how government should be. And so the church is to be neither a human democracy nor a human dictatorship. It is to be the kingdom of Christ with all that that involves. There's more than that. The church should be a community in which taxation is totally unnecessary and in which everybody's needs are met. Now, in a secular government, I think you have to have taxation to make sure that wealth is distributed. You've got to take money from the rich and give it to the poor by law. In a church, there should never be laws of taxation. But in a church, rather, the model community in which voluntarily people give and give and give because they want to. And as the book of Acts has it, no one is in any need because everyone shared. That's a model community. That's the political system. And I dare to say this, and it could be misunderstood. The early church and the true church, wherever it is a model of the millennium, is a good deal nearer communism than capitalism. In the sharing, in people saying, this is not my own property, it's yours, brother, for his sake. In all that, it's nearer the communist ideal. It's a long way from communist method, but it's very near the communist ideal. It's certainly miles away from the capitalist ideal, because the church, when it really responds to Christ, does not accumulate wealth. Silver and gold have I none, says Peter, but what I have I give you. Get up and walk. That's the model community, in which there is sharing, in which government is neither democratic nor dictatorship at the human level, but the kingdom of Christ. There are many other things that I could say. Let me say one or two, yes. Therefore, the church is to be a classless society. There is no doubt whatever that in God's ultimate plan, the kingdom is to be classless. And yet we have to say with shame that far too many churches are one-class churches, depending on the neighborhood in which they are. And while the Lord has led us to neighborhood groups in this church, and already He's blessing that and using it so much to minister to each other, I hope that we shall always be together and that those neighborhoods will always mix. And that we shall always show the world it doesn't matter what your background. Or as somebody said to me, somebody I read this week, it doesn't matter whether you pronounce A-U-S-T-R-I-A, Austria or Austria. Doesn't matter the slightest. Doesn't matter whether you have short A's from the north like I do, or long A's from the south. Doesn't matter. The church is to be classless, it is to be colorblind, it is to be a community in which all sorts and conditions of men meet on equal terms. One of the severest things that the New Testament says is that we are never to give more attention to a rich member than a poor member. Never. Now, all this is the political program for the church as the anticipation of the millennium, as the model community, whereby in its relationships, in its government, in its character, it shows the world the ideal political system in which there is no coercion but an observance of law, because it's the law of love. And if I love my neighbor, I do not kill. I do not commit adultery with his wife. I do not steal. I do not bear false witness against him. But it's a community without laws because it's a community of love. Do you get the message? So we start in our Christian politics with the millennium and say, what kind of pattern will there be when Christ comes back to earth? We then come back one step and say, what kind of pattern can there be in the church, because we already are under Christ and His Spirit is given to us? And what kind of a model society ought we to be? Do you realize that therefore we cannot make any political statement until the church is that model society? Until we've got past simply attending services and being part of a congregation, and until we are showing the government of Christ, the love of Christ, the sharing of Christ, the caring of Christ, until we are the ideal political situation, not the perfect society, we won't be that till we get to glory, but until we can demonstrate in our relationships that we have a political system, and it depends on all of us submitting to one person, our King Jesus. Now that's the second step in the argument. The third step, by the way, there's one lovely little text in Ephesians 3 that I think relates to that, that through the church the manifold wisdom of God might be made known. I like that. In other words, that God's political answer should be seen in the church, and His wonderful, wise way of doing things should be demonstrated. The tragedy is that so often the church conforms to the world and adopts the government, the relationships, the legalism of the world around it. That's when democracy got too much into the churches, because it became too popular around the church. And we didn't stop to ask, what does Christ want? Let me give you another example of how the church must stand for the government of Christ. Now, I realize I'm on really thin ice now, and the angels are pulling back from me. They fear to tread where I'm going to tread now. But I share with you just one thing that I shared with the Men's Contact Club week past Thursday. I believe that God has a form of government and a natural creation order for the relationship between men and women, in which women are not inferior in any way, but in which there is a clear differentiation of function. But we have reached the point now where the pressure is on the church to deny that. It will be illegal after January the 1st for this church to have a men's contact club from which women are excluded. That's why I gave my address last Thursday. It will also be illegal for us to have men-only elders. It will also be illegal for a husband to claim the right and the responsibility of leadership of his wife. Now here is a situation which already church after church is conforming to the world. And I believe doing such damage to the total natural order that ultimately it spells the end of family life. But here is where the church and Christian families within the church can show that the way that works is God's way. And that his pattern and his natural order is the one that we have to stay with. Whatever the pressures of the world on us, have I made my point? Let the church take its orders from Christ and from the Word of God and not from the society around it. And then we can be the model society. I just know that the churches and the homes which get the relationship between men and women scripturally right are the stable and the happy places. God's way is the best way in the long run. Now let's move to the third and final stage. Are you following me in my argument thus far? I realize these sermons are rather different from usual. They're more controversial. They're full of questions. They're making you think. And I don't want you to accept anything I say because I say it. I want you to think it through, grapple with this, because the Archbishop says, what kind of a society do you want? And I want you to be able to tell him and to tell other people what kind of a system we really want. We've started with the first point. We know that the system demands Jesus, and that when he comes, he will have the right system. Secondly, we can already have that system within the church, and must, so that the manifold wisdom of God may be made known to the world. Now comes my third and last stage. Have we anything to say to a secular nation, to a government that is not made up of Christians, as to how they ought to be behaving? That's my third question. Here I'm going to be a little more vague, but I say first we have a prophetic role to play in questioning the system. And Christians should be in the forefront in asking the right questions of a system, in acting as the conscience of the community, in saying this is against the law of God. That's a prophetic role. We must be saying clearly, the economic system is not the final factor. Man shall not live by bread alone. Secondly, we have an evangelistic role to change as many individuals as we can, because the more Christians there are in a country, the nearer that country can live to the ideal. Now here is a very important point. That you can begin to see this kind of situation in a community where there is a sufficient number of Christians to influence public opinion. Alas, we have not got in Britain enough Christians to do that now. Said Abraham Lincoln, you need at least 5% of the population with you before you can change public opinion. And the number of real committed Christians I can find in Britain is 1.5%. You work out, and Guildford alone in this borough, 65,000 people, work out 1.5% and you'll realize I'm almost right on there for Guildford. There are other communities with more, some with less. 1.5%. We are not in a position at the moment to change public opinion. No wonder the social trend is away from the ideal all the time and heading in the direction of a right or a left-wing totalitarianism. We can't stop it and we can't hold it. The Archbishop's had 25,000 replies to his appeal. He needs over 4 million if human opinion is going to be changed in this country. We need 4 million. Does that give us the beginnings of the answer? We have an evangelistic role, and our first task should be to treble the number of Christians in society. But not only do we need to treble them, at least, We need to get them in places where it counts. Salt is no use in the salt cellar, and light is no use under a bushel. And at the moment, you're all under a bushel. The world can't see you. You're under the Millmead bushel. And at the moment, there's just one big heap of salt in the middle of Guildford. And it can't do much good to society right here. We're not met here to do that anyway. But the salt needs to be where it is needed. And unless we get Christians attending the trade union branch meeting as conscientiously as the communist does, and unless we get Christians who are willing to get into the House of Commons, the salt will be no use. And to tell Christians to get out of politics and to get out of these things is to take the salt from the very place where it's needed. Jesus told us you're to be the salt of the earth. And he told us where the salt was to be put. He said the salt needs to be on the dunghill. In days before toilets, they simply had a heap of soil and a shovel and a bowl of salt. And the salt was sprinkled there as a disinfectant to stop bad things spreading. And that's where the salt will have to be to reverse public opinion. And the light will have to be on a bushel, which doesn't mean necessarily having a big parade in Trafalgar Square. It does mean getting Christians into the House of Commons and getting them where decisions are made, getting them onto the management committees, getting them into councils, getting them into these places. So we have an evangelistic role to multiply the number of Christians and to get them into the places where decisions are made. Next, we have a role in raising single issues that are vital to the Christian conscience. And I give you some of them straight away. Without trying to say we've got to have a Christian system, there are a number of things we can begin to try and influence and put right. For example, every Christian will be behind discrimination laws against race. Every Christian will want to push that one along. For example, every Christian is concerned with both production and distribution, and he will want to back any legislation that will encourage proper investment and increased production and more jobs. At the same time, he will also want to back legislation which will see that that improved production does not lead to a few rich and many poor. So in a sense, he will be on both sides and he will fight for both. Every Christian wants to see less competition and more cooperation. I wish we could get rid in this country of the them-us syndrome. It's right in our politics for a very strange reason. When the first commoners were allowed to have a say in politics, they were not given a proper building to meet in. And they had to meet in a borrowed church in Westminster. And so they met in the choir stalls with stalls facing each other like that. And from that beginning, they developed our parliamentary system, which has still stayed in stalls facing each other. And when they built the House of Commons, they modeled it on that choir stall. Wasn't it tragic? When most parliaments today have found out that you discuss much better when you sit in a circle and sit round and talk with each other. And tragedy of tragedies when the House of Commons was bombed and we had the glorious chance to build a place where people could sit around and talk to each other instead of being them and us. Winston Churchill insisted that it be rebuilt exactly as it was. Having made so many wise decisions, he made an awful blunder there. And so right through our politics, there's them and us. Right through industry, them and us. And it goes through all our society, them and us. Now the Christian will want to back anything that will end that and bring cooperation instead of competition. I noticed that Edward Heath said at this conference in Rome on capitalism, that he said crude capitalism has gone and has to go. There is now a need for economic justice. And he said one of the first things we must do is to pass laws that will compel large corporations to allow workers a full say in the future of their firms. That's coming from a Tory, incidentally. It's not coming from a Labour. But I believe that he is seeing something that a Christian has seen and a Christian would back. Competition out, but rather cooperation coming in, and a Christian will work for that politically. A Christian will work to the hardest to oppose the law of the jungle, which in politics means the survival of the fattest. And let me spell that out very clearly. The strong who are exploiting the weak today are the shop floor stewards. And they have such power to bring a large complex industry to a standstill that they can get the wages. And they are not fighting as the early trade union movement fought for the weak to have a share. Now it is the strong who grab. And the people they are hurting are not the very rich who are helped by inflation. You never hear the very rich plead for wage and price control. The people they are hurting are the pensioners and the disabled and the people who are living on savings garnered carefully over years. They're the people they're hurting. And the people who are not in an industry that can be brought to a standstill like that. And behind the present doctors' dispute, which is affecting members of this congregation, is this, that in fact the trade unions have had the power, and the unofficial striker has had greater power, to pull ahead of professionals, to pull right ahead. That's one of the irritations, the disparity, that lies behind the fact that you may not be able to go to hospital for your operation next week. And Christian is very much concerned about this. That the new power, the new strong, the new survival of the fattest, not even the official trade unions, but the unofficial shop stewards, and their power to get what they want, because they can hold a country to ransom. Now, Christian has something to say about that. Whereas once the Christian would speak strongly against the capitalist, the owner, who exploited his hands, it seems to me that now the Christian must speak out very strongly against shop floor power. Which leads to inflation, which hurts those who can ill afford to be hurt, and is not taking money from the very rich into their own pockets. It's taking it from those who cannot afford it. And so a Christian will speak out on these issues. We say because of fallen human nature, there has to be some measure of control in sharing. There has to be taxation. There has to be redistribution. But Christians will vary as to how much control there should be. And that's why I believe it's the will of God that there should be Christians on both sides of the House of Commons and not a Christian party. And that together Christians on both sides can meet to pray and to talk about what control is most Christian. What control will bring the nation nearer to the ideal. I share with you the very sad news that 10 years ago, there were between 40 and 70 members of Parliament in the House of Commons meeting every Tuesday for prayer, praying through the agenda, from all parties, but that no longer meets. There aren't sufficient to meet together to do it. And so, in a sense, we have to press for particular issues to be faced. We have no system, we have no answer. We do not say capitalism is right. We've told you last Sunday what we believe to be wrong with it. We do not say communism is right. I think most Christians will be moderates and they will seek to have the best of both those two systems and to seek to modify the one with the other. They will seek as much control as will bring justice to our land, but not so much that individual freedom is denied. You can see that it will be compromise, compromise all the way. And unless you as a Christian are ready to compromise, you better keep out of politics. What we need are wise men who can see just how much control to put into this situation. Who can see how to encourage production, but how to obtain fair distribution. And who will wrestle with the issues which are not black and white and not clear cut. But Christians who will have ever before them the ideal of the millennium, who will be responsible members of a church in which the system is working, and who will seek to bring Britain as near as possible to that system by encouraging as many people as possible to surrender to Jesus Christ, and by holding the ideal before people, by speaking out on particular issues, showing where the moral principle lies in that particular issue. See, Christians are said to be salt and light. Can I change that metaphor? I'm sure the Lord will let me because I prayed it through with him before the service. The salt, I told you, is to restrain evil as a disinfectant. Can I put it in terms of a motor car? The Christian can put the brake on. He can't control the car. He's not in a sufficient number, but he can put the brake on. And secondly, he can switch the headlamps on as the light of the world. And he can switch the light on and say, hold on, do you see where this is heading? Put the brake on. That's how Christians have operated in politics. They've switched the light on to show people where they're going, to show them the real issues, to show them the moral principles involved. And they've been able to put the brake on as well as putting the lights on. That is their function. From one point of view, you could say that no system will work without Jesus. You can also say that given a sufficient Christian swell of opinion and conviction, any system can be made to work. And so Christians are relatively neutral towards one or the other system. They are not neutral towards issues. And above all, they say, come to the church and see the ideal system. No coercion, but fair distribution. A dictatorship of the most benevolent kind from Jesus through his chosen leaders. Come and see how society could work. But can we ask them to come and see? That's the challenge. Can we show them our politics by inviting them to our fellowship? That's the biggest issue. I must close. The Christian position is therefore ambiguous. He does not have a blueprint. He does not have a system. He points to Jesus. And he says, especially this Christmas time, unto us a child is born. Unto us a son is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulder. And is already on his shoulder. For he ascended on high, and led captivity captive, and all principalities and powers are under his control. And we are under his control. And he is bringing us into that perfect community and already preparing us for it. Sing with the King who is coming to reign. Glory to Jesus, the Lamb that was slain. Hymn number 191. 191. Thank you.